This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the grandson of a fundamentalist Baptist preacher in rural Virginia and the son of a preacher, my guest Eric Ries spent the first 18 years of his life as a compulsory churchgoer. That was followed by 18 more years of trying to extract himself from the church. After doing that, he wanted to create an American gospel that was both religious and democratic, a collection of readings by American philosophers, poets, utopians, and political and religious leaders whose vision is relevant to our country in the 21st century. People like Thomas Jefferson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Walt Whitman, William James, and John Dewey. His new book is called An American Gospel on Family, History, and the Kingdom of God. Ries's previous book, Lost Mountain, was about radical strip mining and the devastation of Appalachia. It won an award for environmental reporting from the Sierra Club, as well as an award from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Ries is a writer in residence at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. Eric Ries, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about your own religious upbringing and your religious life, would you describe what you call the American gospel? Or an American gospel that you've put together?
It's a way of thinking about religion and democracy that is in many ways rooted in the thinking of Thomas Jefferson, his notions of a very decentralized kind of agrarian country. And it's really rooted in the idea, that really fundamental phrase in Luke 17:20 of the kingdom of God, whereas in Luke, it says that the kingdom of God is in our midst. And the gospel that I'm putting together, or that I put together here, is really a way of trying to rethink the way we would live if we thought about the kingdom of God as not something in the sweet hereafter, but something that's actually in the here and now.
What's the vision of Jesus that you grew up with? Your grandfather was a fundamentalist Baptist preacher. Your father was a preacher, too.
Right. It was a very, I guess I would say, oppressive kind of Christianity. It very much emphasized our innate sinfulness, our unworthiness before God, and it was a heavy kind of Christianity. The American philosopher William James made a distinction between what he called religion of the sick soul and religion of healthy-mindedness. And I think in many ways my grandfather preached a religion of the sick soul. Not that he wasn't a very loving man, because he was, but I think he really thought that his job was to get his congregation to save their souls, and the way to do that was to convince them of their guilt and their sin. That was the sort of simple message that he preached to his congregation.
Are there any things from his sermons that you vividly remember?
I remember he preached a sermon about the creation story, the Genesis creation story, and it was about how the serpent had tricked us into disobeying God, and that because we had been tricked, we were just innate sinners. And because we were innate sinners, God had to send his son to save us all. And it was a very forceful kind of sermon. And it was a sermon that was supposed to lead, as all of my grandfather's sermons were, to people coming forward and confessing their sins at the front of the church, kneeling beside him. And it was a very, very dynamic sermon. My grandfather was a very dynamic, charismatic preacher, and I just remember sitting in the third pew with my grandmother, listening to him pound the pulpit and really express this real force over his congregation.
What was it like for you when you were young, and all of these people who decided they were sinners would come up to the front of their church to kneel by your grandfather, the preacher? Was that powerful for you? Was it alienating for you? Like, what did you feel watching that?
It was powerful. This was a small fishing village in Tidewater, Virginia. My grandfather was the moral force, the head of the community, and I understood this, and I understood the power that he wielded, and I understood that he was never wrong, that what he said was right, and that I needed to constantly be questioning my own life and my own sinfulness, and really doing a lot of soul searching, as clearly everybody else that was coming forward was.
Because your grandfather believed in a kind of punitive religion, where, you know, unless you like walk the line, you'd be punished and go to hell. Was his religion a comfort to you, or did it scare you?
It scared me. It wasn't really a comfort. I remember when I would stay with my grandparents for long periods of time, just the fear that would overcome me, that it was really a fear that my grandfather would go to one place and I would go to another place. It was a fear of being separated from him and from my grandmother.
You mean like heaven and hell, that kind of
separation?
Right,
mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And so it was, it really was a fear. And it's something that later in life I began to think about, well, if we took all the fear out of Christianity, then what do we have left? And so it was a question, and it was a influence that stuck with me.
Now, your father was a preacher too, but he took his life at the age of 33 when you were 3 years old?
Right.
Would you describe how your father took his life?
Well, he had a 22 rifle that my grandfather had given him for, it was a hunting rifle, and my mother had taken, she was a school teacher, and she had dropped me off at the babysitter, and she had gone to school, and when we came home in the afternoon, my father had never gotten out of bed, and he had shot himself.
You ascribe his suicide to two things. One, brain chemistry, because he had bipolar disorder.
Right.
And the other, religion. How do you think religion figured into your father's suicide?
I think the two things really just reinforced each other. I don't think either one probably would have led to the suicide. But I think that my father, first of all, probably shouldn't have become a preacher. I mean, he felt the pressure from my grandfather to be a preacher, but he wasn't very good at it. He was very introspective, very quiet. I think he would have been a good seminarian or a Bible scholar or a teacher or something like that. But he did feel the pressure from my grandfather to sort of carry on this family tradition. But I don't think he could really ever escape the heaviness of my grandfather's fundamentalism. I think that just innate, inherent sinfulness, that guilt, was just something that he couldn't ever shake it, and he could never step outside of my grandfather's shadow. And so I don't feel like he could really ever find his own way. He could never find any accommodation. And so at one point, he really felt like the best thing he could do for himself and for everybody was to end his own life, and my mother feels no bitterness about it. She says to this day that she honestly feels that he thought he was doing us a favor.
20 years after your father's suicide, your mother gave you the Bible, which he had used since his days in seminary, and the cloth marker was at Matthew 10. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of that for us. This is on page 28 of your book.
Okay. Never imagine I have come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Yes, a man's own household will be his enemies. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He who will not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it.
Now, when you found that your father's Bible was marked to this page, you couldn't know for sure what that meant, whether it was an accident or whether that's really what he had been reading before he killed himself, whether this was a significant passage for him or not. But your reaction in the book to this passage is, who is the egomaniac speaking these words? Would you elaborate on that reaction?
Well, it's it just struck me as who was this person speaking 2,000 years ago, a complete historical stranger, saying that we should love him who we are really incapable emotionally of loving more so than we love our own fathers and our own sons. And it just seemed like a incredibly egomaniacal kind of claim to make. And on the one hand, I could conclude that this was something that my father simply couldn't do. Or on the other hand, I can conclude that it's something he took very literally, though from everything everybody told me, he wasn't the kind of person that would have done that.
My guest is Eric Reese. His new book is called An American Gospel on Family, History, and the Kingdom of God. So at some point, you broke with the church. You felt, I think it's fair to say, you felt like your father felt imprisoned by the church and didn't know how to get out because of his ties to his father, who was also a preacher. But you left the church at what age?
Well, our church burned down when I was 17 years old, and I took that as a pretty good omen that I should get out then. And I never really went back, and it caused quite a bit of hurt feelings among my family. But it was really then that I sort of set out on my own religious pursuit.
And I think it's interesting, some of the people who you excerpt in the American Gospel you've put together are poets and writers. Like Walt Whitman has a very prominent place in the American Gospel you've put together. Now, you're an English professor, so I suppose I shouldn't be shocked that you're turning to poets. But tell us why. Why turn to poets when trying to understand religion?
Well, I think there's a lot of poetry in the Bible, and I think that the imagination is really an incredible moral force. The imagination helps us to belong inside our own skins and to belong in the world in an intense kind of way, and it helps us imagine a better future. And so I think poetry is very important in that sense. Emerson said that poets are liberating gods, and I think they can liberate us to see things differently. And so it was sort of with that impulse, I guess, that I began really thinking seriously about Walt Whitman, because he is such a poet that is he's really a celebrator of life, and he has a religious view, but it's a religious view that's so different from my grandfather's, because it really is one that sees the creation infused with the Creator and with the sense of the divine, and it really does portray the natural world as the kingdom of God, and I found that very, very inspiring.
There's an excerpt of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass that you include in your book. There's several excerpts you include in your book, but there's one in particular that I'm going to ask you to read that's on page 114. Why don't you read it and then tell us why you've chosen it?
Okay. I see something of God each hour of the 24, and each moment then. In the faces of men and women I see God, and in my own face in the glass. I find letters from God dropped in the street, and every one is signed by God's name. And I leave them where they are, for I know that others will punctually come forever and ever.
Why is this such an important passage to you?
Well, I think, again, this is Whitman saying that he sees the divine in the ordinary. He sees the work of God in this world, in both the natural world and in other human beings, and it's again, it's that religion of healthy mindedness that I think really helped me begin to understand that religion didn't have to be this heavy, dogmatic, guilt-ridden kind of force, that it could actually be a very, very inspiring force.
There's something I really want to play for you. Have you heard the Fred Hirsch musical settings for Leaves of Grass?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I have to play it for you. Fred Hirsch is a jazz pianist, but a few years ago, he took parts of Leaves of Grass, set it to music, and this passage is one of the passages that he set to music. So here it is, and Kurt Elling is the singer.
Why should I wish to see God better than on this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24, and each moment then, in the faces of men and women, I see God, and in my own face in the glass, I find letters from God dropped in the street, and everyone is signed by God's name, and I leave them where they are, for I know that wherever I go, others will punctually come forever and ever.
So that was Fred Hirsch's musical setting for a passage from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass with Kurt Elling singing. Isn't that beautiful?
It is, you know, and it really reminds you that one of the great services Whitman did for us was that he really brought together body and soul. There's so much of a dualism in a lot of fundamentalist Christianity, and there was a lot of it in my grandfather's. And Whitman was bringing these things back together again. I remember I was walking with my grandfather once, and we were having a good conversation about nature. He loved nature. And I said something, I quoted a line of Whitman about, if somebody asks to see the soul, then I point to this tree and this rock. And my grandfather became very icy, and he said, that's pantheism. And I don't think it was. I think Whitman was not saying we worship the trees and in the natural world, but that we see the handwriting of God there.
My guest is Eric Reese, and he has a new book called An American Gospel on Family, History, and the Kingdom of God. He's put together An American Gospel, excerpts of texts ranging from the Gospel of Thomas to Thomas Jefferson's reworking of the New Testament. Also included in the American Gospel you've put together is William James, the psychologist and philosopher who died in 1910. Tell us about one or two of the excerpts from his work that you've included that are meaningful to you.
Well, there's one excerpt where he says that religion should, the purpose of religion should be to make life more interesting and more meaningful, not less. And I thought that was very important because in many ways I look back at my grandfather's religion and it did kind of make life seem not that interesting because life was this thing we were supposed to escape. And for James, it was just the opposite. And he took it further and he said that the one of the main tenets of American pragmatism, which is the only school of philosophy that America has ever contributed to the world, he said that one of the main tenets here is that if you have a belief, that belief has to lead to an action. If you simply believe something but it doesn't change the way you do things, then it really isn't of any consequence. And so James said that religion should be a habit of action. And I think that's something that in a lot of mainstream Christianity we tend to forget. So James was very important to me in that sense.
You know, I'm just thinking about some of the things you said earlier about your father's suicide and about the pain that religion caused you when you were growing up. In a fundamentalist family with the idea, the main idea of religion being sin. You know, don't do this, don't do that,
right.
You will suffer. And do you think of religion as having caused a lot of pain in your life?
Yeah, I do. I think it was inadvertent. I don't think anybody meant to inflict it on me. In many ways, I inflicted it upon myself because I took to heart probably too much of this emphasis on sin and guilt. I mean, it's interesting to look at my mother because to her, Christianity is very liberating. It's a force that really helps her in her life. even the fundamentalist kind of religion. And I guess I was just sort of psychologically tuned to see it more the way my father saw it and less the way my mother saw it. So I guess that's more as much about me as it is about the message that my grandfather was preaching.
Do you go to church now?
No, I don't. I usually spend Sundays out in the woods.
Eric Reese, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Eric Reese is the author of the new book, An American Gospel, on Family, History, and the Kingdom of God. He's a writer in residence at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Trumpet player Charles Tolliver made some big band recordings in the 1970s and played his arrangements with a few European jazz orchestras. In 2003, he revived his big band for gigs in New York, and later they made an album for Blue Note. In February, Tolliver's band recreated the charts for Thelonious Monk's 1959 Town Hall concert. They now have a new live album out. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the band is hitting its stride.
Charles Tolliver's big band playing the blues and diving headlong into the cheerful exuberance that's a big band's birthright. Tolliver came up in the 1960s among musicians who took their cues from John Coltrane's splashy, high-energy modal jazz, where players would stretch out a while on a single chord or scale. Tolliver's big band honors those roots. Marcus Strickland stirring the cauldron on tenor saxophone. That's from the Charles Tolliver Big Band's Emperor March, recorded live last year in New York. Most every big band smacks of urban bustle, trafficking in horn riffs and counter riffs. Tolliver's mass trumpets, saxes, and trombones call out to each other like friendly rivals who are on the same side. Musical formations build excitement like a big band when everyone piles on like that. You can hear what these leviathans get from the polyrhythmic energy of Cuban orchestras, even when the material is not officially Latin. Plenty of good soloists here, including trumpeter Charles Tolliver himself and saxophonist Bill Saxton and Billy Harper, who's featured on a favorite ballad of Coltrane's, I Want to Talk About You. But above all, big bands need forceful drummers. This one is Gene Jackson, who catches those Latin inflections and lays down a size triple E broad beat. Even when horns melt away to let the rhythm trio run, they play like 16 players are still at their backs. Bassist Reggie Workman was in Tolliver's 70s big band. Anthony Wanzi is on piano. The golden age of big bands is long gone. And in truth, most modern bands don't come close to matching swing-era orchestras for precision or playing in tune, though there are many worse offenders than this one. Charles Tolliver's album, Emperor March, shows why a few idealists continue to mount these high-overhead, lucky-if-we-break-even ensembles of a dozen and a half players. They're a lot of fun to write for and play in and to listen to.
Kevin Whitehead is currently on leave from teaching at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Emperor March, live at the Blue Note, by the Charles Tolliver Big Band. Once you've had a bite of salty French fries or a cheeseburger with all the extras or a cinnamon bun, you want more and more. It can be hard to stop eating, even when you're full. It's not just you. Years of research has taught former FDA Commissioner David Kessler that sugar, fat, and salt change the brain. Those ingredients are the stars of Kessler's new book, The End of Overeating. It's about why there's so much sugar, fat, and salt in fast food and processed food, and how that's affecting our brains as well as our waistlines. Kessler was the FDA commissioner under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He's the former dean of the medical schools at Yale and the University of California, San Francisco. David Kessler, welcome to Fresh Air. In your book, you blame overeating not only on a lack of willpower, but you say we're eating foods basically that are designed, perhaps intentionally designed, to get us to just keep eating, and that things like sugar, fat, and salt increase your craving. Why do they do that? Why do we keep wanting more sugar when we're eating something sweet, or more salt when we're eating popcorn or pretzels or potato chips?
We used to think of food was something we ate to fill us up, to satiate us. But in fact, much of the food that we're eating, this trifecta of sugar, fat, and salt, stimulate us. And what we now see is the science that shows that much of the food that we're eating, that's very highly palatable food, is excessively activating the neural circuitry of many of our brains. We used to just think that, you know, food tasted good, but we now know what's behind that. And for many of us, the reason we keep on eating is because of the sustained stimulation.
Now, you describe how foods that sound really healthy, like a potato or a chicken breast, can really just become vehicles for the trifecta of salt, fat, and sugar. Give us an example of a food that it kind of sounds healthy, but when you're done with it, when the industry is done with it, it isn't.
Take the spinach dip. You see the word spinach on the menu. You think, boy, that's good for me. What is it? You know, it's fat and salt with some green things in them. Even our basic chicken breast increasingly has food that's injected or marinated or mixed in a huge cement mixer, and it has sugar and fat and salt injected into it. You know, and it's very stimulating. It's very highly effective in getting us to eat more and more.
But, you know, as you point out in your book, restaurants aren't shy about advertising all the stuff, not ingredient per ingredient, but how rich these foods are. And you give an example from the TGI Friday menu, and you describe TGI Fridays as the chain restaurant designed to be the ultimate food carnival. So this is one appetizer, the Parmesan-crusted Sicilian quesadilla. And it says, packed with sautéed chicken, sausage, bruschetta marinara, and bacon, and oozing with Monterey Jack cheese. We coat it with Parmesan and pan-fry it to a crispy golden brown, then drizzle it with balsamic glaze. So what's going on in that Parmesan-crusted Sicilian quesadilla?
If you translate what it says on the menu, what is it? It's fat on fat on fat on salt on fat. That's what it is.
Let me read another menu item. And this is how the menu describes it, or at least how it described it when you were writing the book. And this is from Chili's, which is another chain restaurant. And this is the margarita grilled chicken. That sounds pretty healthy. Okay, so here's a description. We start with tender, juicy chicken breast, marinate it with our classic margarita flavoring, and grill it to perfection. And then the dish is served with rice, beans, strips of fried tortilla, and salsa. And that sounds pretty good. So what are your objections to the margarita grilled chicken?
Well, if you go look what's actually in the chicken, let me read you what's in there. It contains a 15% solution of a marinade, which that marinade has orange juice, sweet and sour mix, which is sugar, citric acid, soybean oil, artificial colorings, has triple sec, canola oil, tequila, salt, and that's all added inside the chicken.
Because of the marinade.
The marinade, it's mixed in this huge mixer. Sometimes it looks like a cement mixer. And so you have these sugary fat syrups added inside the chicken. You think you're eating good grilled chicken. You think it's healthy. Only then do you understand that you have this solution of this sugar, fat, and salt added to something that we think is healthy.
And it's not like you can say, hold the sauce, because it's already embedded in the chicken.
It's, unfortunately, it's hold the chicken.
Well, you actually have a theory about conditioned hyper-eating. That's what you call it. What do you mean by conditioned hyper-eating?
What the science seems to be showing, and it's still evolving, is that for many of us, many people who are susceptible, highly palatable foods, the foods that we're eating every day now, are excessively activating the neural circuitry of our brain. And for many of us, once we get stimulated, our brains, this neural circuitry doesn't shut off. And the behavior becomes, and this is important, it becomes not only conditioned, but it becomes driven. When it comes, you know, to certain stimuli and certain neural circuits, not only does it form habits, not only do I learn it, but I become motivated to seek it out. So the behavior becomes conditioned and driven. You know, we used to think it's simply a matter, if you want to control your weight, it's a matter of willpower. No one's given us the tools to be able to deal with it. Diet and exercise? Sure, it'll work for some period of time. I take you and I put you on a diet, but I don't change your brain circuitry. I get you through the next 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. Yes, you lose the weight, but then I put you back in your environment. I can continue to cue you, and I've not added any new learning on top of that old learning. And what's going to happen? Of course you're going to gain the weight back.
So what are some of your suggestions for effective food rehab?
There are things I can do just to decrease the amount of stimulation. So don't cue me. You know, take that bread away. I don't want to see that, because that's only going to increase the stimulation. Or don't deprive me, because if deprivation is only going to increase the reward value. So taking away the cues, not being primed, decreasing deprivation, all those can decrease being stimulated. But how realistic in our current environment? So, you know, the ultimate goal is to cool down the stimulus. And the way to do that is to want something more. Set rules for myself. I can this now. So rules work, structured eating in meals. But ultimately, is to have what psychologists call shame. Great. But if you can get to the point of looking at those that food, that plate of nachos, and say, boy, that's just fat on it's called the reward value of the stimulus. Then when you're stimulus, your brain doesn't get stimulated. You don't get activated.
One of the ways that you can find out now what you're actually putting into your system is if you shop for
that of the people I was interviewing in the book, in the food industry, said, you know, Kessler, this is all your fault because you were pretty effective in putting on processed food. Went to restaurants, and that there was no food label.
Would you like to see food labels in restaurants so that when we ate a cheeseburger or a nacho, that we'd have the same information we'd get if we'd bought it in a supermarket?
I think disclosure is very important. But it's also important to understand that eating has to be pleasurable. It has to be rewarding. But we have to adjust, and I think what's critical is we need to change how America looks at food. You know, the plain hamburger may be fine. I'm not here to give nutrition advice, and some of my colleagues will disagree with me. But you get a hamburger, 400 or 500 calories at a meal, you know, I don't have a lot of problems with that. It's when that hamburger has layers and upon layers, you know, of bacon and cheese and dressings. And you take that 400 and 500 calories and you make it 800 or 1200 or 1500 calories. That's where I think the damage is being done.
What are your concerns about children who grow up with this highly fat, sugar, salt kind of fast food? And that's their normal. That's the kind of zetzed up food that they think is normal food, and that's the way their compass is set when they desire food.
As a pediatrician, that gives me the greatest concern, because I now understand that once you lay down that neural circuitry that gets activated by this highly palatable food, you lay down that learning. That learning stays with you for life. And we have children now 3, 4, 5 years of age who are eating constantly all day fat, sugar, and salt. They've never been hungry for a moment in their lives. If you look at the science, what we used to see was that children at ages 2 and 3 and 4 used to compensate for their eating, which meant if I gave them more calories at one meal, they would eat less later on in the day. Now, by giving them this highly palatable, rewarding food, they've lost the ability to compensate. The reward circuits of their brain have taken over any of the homeostatic mechanisms that allowed them to control their eating in the first place.
Well, I can hear some people thinking, is now he going to recommend that the government regulate McDonald's or regulate TGI Fridays? Do we want the government being in the kitchen with the chef?
If you look at the great public health successes, if you look at tobacco, if you look at seatbelts, how did we win those battles? Sure, there's a role for government, I mean, in part. But in the end, what did we do? We changed the way we look at tobacco. We changed the way I get in a car and I don't feel normal unless I put on that seatbelt. So yes, government has a role, the industry has a role, we as consumers have a role, but the first thing is we have to change how we look at food, and this is about our relationship with food. It's not simply a matter of government regulation.
David Kessler, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Kessler is a former FDA commissioner. His new book is called The End of Overeating. Our critic at large, John Powers, has been watching the TV series Party Down. The series ends Friday, but John had a sneak peek of the last episode and declares it a winner along with all the rest.
When I first moved out to Los Angeles, a friend joked that the city's motto should be, "But really I'm." as in, I work as a waiter, but really, I'm an actor. Or, I may be selling you jeans, but really, I'm writing a script. Of course, most Angelenos actually don't have aspirations to showbiz. But hundreds of thousands do dream of hitting it big, even as they do jobs that feel small. Theirs is the world of Party Down, a comedy series on Stars that might be the love child of Ricky Gervais and Judd Apatow. It's about Hollywood fringesters who work for a catering company called Party Down. And each half-hour episode takes place entirely at one of the events where they're serving. Everything from high school reunions and porn awards parties to ceremonies for a college conservative caucus. We meet the Party Down team through the watchful eyes of its new bartender, Henry, played by Adam Scott, who looks like a flattened-out version of Tom Cruise. Henry's a washed-out actor whose great claim to fame is a beer commercial, where he says, "Are we having fun yet?" a line superbly deployed throughout the series. Henry's instantly drawn to Casey, a struggling comedian played with enormous verbal brio by Lizzie Kaplan, an actress I find uncommonly fetching. Henry and Casey are the sharp ones, along with Roman. That's the reliably acerbic Martin Starr, a wannabe screenwriter who loves sci-fi and yearns to get laid. The other three are sweetly dim dreamers. There's the catering team leader, Ron, played with manic desperation by Ken Marino, who dreams of opening a soup franchise restaurant. There's the cocky but sweet actor, Kyle. That's Ryan Hansen, who has a delightfully easy style. And then there's Constance, a fading bit player who still talks about working with Jan Michael Vincent. She's played by Jane Lynch, one of our great comic treasures. The show's backdrop changes from week to week. What's always the same are these six characters, who inhabit a sitcom riff on a Beckett universe where everyone is always at work and waiting for the break that will spring them from limbo. Until that happens, they swap stories and hook up, malinger, and badmouth their clients. Here at a business retreat, Roman starts ranting to Henry and Kyle about the guest speaker, the L.A. Laker-turned-actor Rick Fox.
Why would anyone pay money to see Rick Fox speak on any topic?
Well, he's a winner, Roman, and people want to hear what winners have to say.
No, a winner is like Arthur C. Clarke or Stephen Hawking or Kafka. He's just some 8-foot-tall freak.
When did you turn so completely against Rick Fox?
A, he was overrated on the Lakers, and B, he's all over Casey like a sleaze.
You're jealous of Rick Fox. That's hilarious.
When I first saw Party Down, I thought the idea was better than the execution. Like many shows, it took a few episodes to hit its stride. Now the show is genuinely funny and filled with terrific writing, as in the great scene when Roman blows his chances with a sci-fi-loving porn actress named Cramsey because she likes the wrong kind of science fiction. Or the recent episode when Russian gangsters treat the Party Down team as celebrities, because Eastern Europe is one place where they actually show the straight-to-video movies and TV shows that actors like Kyle and Constance have been in. The whiff of failure makes Party Down the flip side of that other Hollywood series, Entourage, whose ordinary guys get to live large. Cool cars, hot chicks, fancy restaurants. Where that fizzy HBO series was an almost perfect expression of a bubble economy, Party Down seems just right for an economic downturn in which people still harbor oversized American dreams, but know they need a job to survive. And though the show has fun with the characters' foibles and limitations, they're all slightly deformed by their ambitions, it avoids what we might call Day of the Locust syndrome. It doesn't look at them as little people or treat them with fear and disdain. It's affectionate. Everything turns around Henry, who, as episodes spin out of control, remains the show's still center. Beautifully underplayed by Scott, he reveals himself in bone-dry quips and almost imperceptible inner crumples that betray his mortified sense of his place in the world. Alone of the six, Henry has abandoned his hopes of the big time, but what's great is that this has made him humane, not cynical. Even when his co-workers are being foolish, he never looks down on their dreams. Wised up and sad, he's Party Down's hero and melancholy heart. He knows that he's not an actor. He really is a bartender.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Party Down is on the Stars Network and can be seen on demand, in reruns, and streaming from Netflix. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.